Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
The day before my sister's pretend wedding, the family gathered in Maine for our annual meeting at my grandfather's island house, so he could tell us how much of a disappointment we'd been. Dressed like a clam digger in rubber boots, filthy canvas pants, and an old sweatshirt full of pipe ash holes, he rose from his wing chair and levered himself to his feet with his cane. Stains extended from his collar to his knees, because at mealtimes he used himself as a plate. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host of New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I'm talking to Jason Brown, author of A Faithful but Melancholy Account of Several Barbarities Lately Committed. In this collection, 10 stories are linked together by their connection to an area on the coast of Maine and the family of John Stoughton Howland. Hi, Jason. Thanks for joining me today.
Hello, Gleep. Thanks for having me on.
So let's get started. How did you come up with the Howland family and what made you write this book?
I started writing about the Howlands quite a few years ago, maybe 8 years ago. I grew up in Maine and in a family, in a New England family on my father's side, who's lived in the same 200-mile radius since our ancestor John Howland came over on the Mayflower, and so I'm actually related to the original Howland that's referenced in the book. My last name is Brown, but you know, one of my great grandmothers was a Howland, so it's semi autobiographical, I guess. The book is.
Wow. Okay. And then what made you write the book?
What made me write the book? You know, that's an interesting question. For me, I grew up in this, what felt like a very specific, world. It didn't feel that way when I was growing up in it, this sort of Northern New England, world where we were related to a lot of people. I spent a lot of time around cousins, second cousins. I lived with my grandparents for periods of time, and I had a very intense sense of sort of belonging to the place where I grew up. And when I left New England in my 20s, I've always felt a sort of longing for that kind of belonging and identity that I had growing up. At the same time that I also felt that it was sort of oppressive, that I had always wanted to escape it. And I think now that I'm a little bit older, there's a mixture of nostalgia and, you know, that I've felt for my own past, but also because I'm not just writing for myself, I'm trying to contextualize the kind of cultural upbringing that I had through fiction, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about Howland Island. Is that a real place? And tell us about the part of Maine where it is.
The Howland Island that I'm writing about. I think there probably is a Howland Island somewhere, but the one I'm writing about is a fictional island. It's based on a real place where I spent a lot of time. but it's definitely a fictional place. But the location, the area of Maine is mid-coast Maine, the Sheepskit Bay, and that's more or less where I grew up in that area. And John Howland, the actual John Howland, the original Mayflower passenger, came to that area to do trading within the first few years of the Mayflower landing. And then a lot of the sort of Mayflower people ended up in Maine and New Hampshire in subsequent generations for various reasons, for fishing. But a lot of them were actually kicked out of, a lot of my ancestors were kicked out of the Plymouth colony because they weren't religious enough, or they weren't, they weren't adhering to the rules. So a lot of early Maine and New Hampshire people were early sort of rebels of the Plymouth colony.
Yeah. Aside from the familial relationships, the land itself is a consistent character across the stories. Was that your intention?
Yeah, it's very much my intention. I mean, I not only grew up, on the coast and in boats and with a real sense of the land and the ocean, but I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, who gave me a distinct feeling of my family history. Many of my ancestors were ship captains, and there are a lot of stories about my early ancestors and the adventures they had, and so but I think it's true of a lot of people that you don't feel so strongly for a place necessarily until you leave it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then you begin to feel, then it takes on a life of its own in your memory. And that's something that happens to the main character, the younger John in the book, is that he ends up moving to the West Coast, and he's both drawn back to where he came from and also feels like he doesn't fit in there anymore.
Didn't he move to Oregon?
Yeah, he did.
Interesting.
I live in Oregon now. Yeah.
So. Is he a professor at the university there currently?
No.
On sabbatical in Colorado?
he wishes he were.
Okay. So let's unpack all the stories. There's 10 of them. The first one is set in 2003. John Stoughton Howland is a widowed old man trying to sneak out of the house.
Yeah.
And he's trying to get his little visiting grandson to lie about where he is. So right. Talk about John.
John is not my grandfather. And I think that's true of a lot of the fiction that I've loved over the years. The fiction by Tobias Wolfe or Raymond Carver or Alice Munro. I often feel like when I'm a huge Alice Munro fan. And when I read her stories, I often feel like I'm reading sort of iterations of her life, characters who are based on her or based on people she knew. But in any case, the John in this first story is largely based on my grandfather, who was a World War II veteran and was one of the liberators of one of the camps. He never told any of those stories until in the months before he died. So he kept all his sort of war experiences inside until the months before he died. And so we had no idea what he had experienced and no idea how much it had affected him. And that's to some extent what this story is about.
Yeah. Do you consider John's experience, like your grandfather's, during World War II to be the pivotal moment of his life?
I think it was probably, I was very close to I consider myself to have been very close to my grandfather, but the war was something he never talked about. And so it was very hard to tell, if it was a pivotal moment, if it was the pivotal moment in his life. And I think that's true of a lot of people who live in the world that I grew up in. That's true of a lot of people, I think, in his generation, the so-called greatest generation, is that they kept things deeply buried inside. And on some level, you felt like you didn't know them. And what I did end up feeling is that, it was sort of sad that there was a whole side of his life that I didn't come to know before he died. And I think that, he may have felt, he to some extent felt isolated by this experience and not having shared it, you know? So I think to some extent, the story is about that, a degree of loneliness that people who experience something so extreme, like, that kind of combat or war or trauma, they can feel very isolated if they keep it inside their whole lives. I mean, we now live in a different time, but in that era, I think many of those people and those veterans, and especially these sort of repressed New Englanders who I grew up among, they felt very isolated, you know, and that was, it's part of my looking back on not just my own family experience, but the cultural experience that I grew up with and what is, you know, how is love expressed? You think you're close to somebody, but you don't really know them because they've walled off so much of themselves, you know, from everyone else. So I think that the story is sort of reflecting on all those things and how they fit together.
Mm-hmm. In the second story, John's grandson, John Jacobs Howland, recalls staying with his grandparents in the summer of 1981. So I'm just wondering, where were you in the summer of 1981? And John remembers the story very vividly. So I'm wondering, what are your memories of that summer?
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, living, I was living very much like the character. I was living with my grandparents in 1981 in the summer. And they're living on an island, you know, in Maine. And they're surrounded by a lot of summer people and a lot of people who are not summer people. And those are two different, very different categories that our family sort of fit into both of those categories because we lived in Maine year round, but we were also this island. We were on this island where we had had a place. My family's had a place for many generations. And that island is mostly sort of populated by summer people from out of state. And so it captures a little bit of that divide. But I think the vividness of the memory is fueled by, you know, the author's sense of nostalgia, but also the characters, you know, transferred through the narrator's sense of, you know, the intensity of that childhood experience. And what you come to see right away in that story and in the following story is that the character, the narrator of those of The Last Voyage of the Alice B. Toklas doesn't feel that close to his parents. And so these experiences that he's remembering with his grandparents, I think, are intensified as a result of the distance he felt from his own parents.
Okay. Talk about Don Quixote. He comes up
in that story. Yeah. That story is about, to me, I mean, it's about many things. And the grandfather is obsessed with Don Quixote. And it's meant to be comic because in some ways the grandfather is sort of Don Quixote. He's living in a bit of a fantasy world. And a fantasy world that puts himself at the center of a heroic tale. So it's a little bit of a meditation on Don Quixote and, you know, is Don Quixote is the grandfather an absurd figure for us to make fun of, or is the world absurd, you know? The grandson is at a sort of young adolescent stage, where, you know, he's trying to figure out if his grandparents' reality is his reality, you know? And this story marks the beginning of him realizing that his grandparents' world is his world, but it's also a world that's, isolated and delusional to some extent. And so I'm trying to make a sort of meta commentary also on, you know, this cultural group and their sort of trajectory and role in American history, you know. They see themselves and have seen themselves as the very sort of center of American culture and American life and American history. And by the time of this story takes place, that's starting to pivot and change. And on a national level, but for the character, for the grandson, he's realizing the same thing. You know, he's, I am not my grandfather. I am not, I can't just absorb this history and stay on this island and become part of that trajectory. I have to go out and join the world and readjust my orientation to it, you know?
Now we're in the third story, The Return of the Native, and the same guy, John Jacobs Howland, the same grandson, he remembers the end of the following summer, 1982. Is this as personal a story as it feels like?
It's not directly autobiographical, but it is very personal, if that makes any sense. I mean, the sort of fictional tradition that I was raised in, if you will, involves sort of transferring, you know, one's actual history into a slightly fictionalized version. And many of the writers I admired and still admire do just that. And so my mother did not go off to California as the character's mother does. But in many ways, I felt as though my parents were sort of in a lost generation, the 60s generation. And my grandparents in some ways stepped into that void, if you will, and were a sort of solid force for me. And so that part of it is autobiographical, you know?
Mm-hmm. So now it's 1990. And John is recovering from his own addictions, working at a home for traumatized children who'd been removed from their foster homes. He finds himself in a difficult situation. Why does he make such terrible decisions?
Because he's selfish and afraid and weak and self-centered. Well, there's a lot of terrible decisions in that story, I suppose. I mean, the decisions that lead him to rehab, all of which predates the time of the story. I didn't want to write all that that material. I've written it before in other books, and this is a story where he's trying to get back on his feet, as you say, and he's doing it through trying to help these people, these kids whose suffering is so much more extreme than his own, really. And he's terrified by their suffering is the best way I can put it. And he doesn't rise to the challenge of, being able to be there for people who need him. You know, he takes this job, among kids who have so much need. Their need is almost to sort of limitless. They're so damaged, and he's incapable of meeting that challenge, and he runs from it. And in doing so, he's essentially also running from himself and running back to his own problems. And so it's a tough story. It's easier to write that kind of story in retrospect. You know, I mean, it's easy to, I was that kind of person at one time in my life, and it's easier to write that story now that I'm much older.
Okay, so now a couple years later, and you kind of switch gears here. Suddenly the story is being told in third person, and the only Howland mentioned is mane wearing.
Yep, yeah.
It's in the aftermath of a huge flood in the same town. Vaughn, right?
Yep. Yes, that's right.
Okay. Yeah. So tell us about mane wearing and what's his connection to John Stoughton, and what about this story?
This story, Flood, is it's only thematically connected to the main character. The main character I see as John, the younger John, we've been talking about him, and he's the main focus of the five of the 10 stories. And this story doesn't really have anything directly to do with him. It is thematically connected to him. The main character of Flood is based on a friend of mine. He's a lot like John in that he's had sort of emotional and psychological struggles and struggles with addiction, but he is from a different kind of background. he's from much more of a working class background, and he has a different relationship to his history, his family history. And I very much wanted to pull away from the family at various points in the book and not make the family the center point of every story, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's true. But in the same story, everyone is remembering the grandfather, but we're not talking about John Stoughton here.
No, that's a different, okay. Yeah, that's a different grandfather.
So, but there's still, it's still about a grandfather.
That's right.
Who might or might not have killed somebody that nobody ever talks about.
Yeah. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things that no one ever talks about. I mean, and I'm sure that's true in many families, but it's certainly true in the kind of New England families that I knew.
Murder? Nobody would have mentioned it in passing?
Well, I'm supposedly related to Lizzie Borden, and that was kind of kept under the rug for many years. And then,
okay, yeah, we keep that under the rug too.
And then my grandmother's aunt shot herself when she was 18, she was about 19, I guess, or 20. And anyway, I mean, maybe that's something you would think that wouldn't come out, but it was a very dramatic event in its time, and I didn't discover it until I was 37.
So nobody ever talked about it again?
No, I was the first one my grandmother knew, but she died with that information. Hmm. And my great aunt was was first in her class at Vassar at the time that she shot herself. And my grandmother, who wanted to go to Vassar, was forbidden to go because they blamed the suicide on too much education for women.
Ooh.
And so my grandmother was refused an education because her father was afraid that the same thing would happen to her. And so these sort of threads, these historical threads happen in families, and they happen on a larger cultural level. And that's kind of what my book is about, the way this sort of history passes down through us on a cultural level and on a personal and familial level. And the two sort of mirror each other in various ways. And we're only partially conscious of the histories that we inherit, you know.
So moving forward to 2000, the year 2000, and now Phoebe Hutchinson Howland, so still someone connected, is charged to sell the house where her father grew up. And this is the story called The Wreck of the Ipswich Sparrow. She finds a newspaper clipping about the aunt whose house it was. So what's the connection between this family and John Stoughton Howland?
Well, Phoebe is the younger John's cousin.
Right.
And
okay.
So that's the connection. It's still the same family, but it's the sort of larger family. And so this wouldn't be the house where our main character grew up. But so I wanted to have a story that was about the Howland family, but that wasn't about the main character's sort of immediate family. Anyway, this is a story that I have a lot of personal affection for. I guess I wrote it. So I did a lot of historical research and also used family documents, and it's meant to sort of illustrate some of what I've been saying about the way in which sort of history kind of intrudes into the present, you know.
It's a story of survival. What do you want the reader to take away from it?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think a lot of things. I mean, the sense of our own history and our relationship to it is the main theme, I think. The main character, Phoebe, finds herself in California, and as I did in my mid-20s. And, you know, one of my favorite novels when I was younger, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, has a sort of scene that takes place in California that really struck home for me, because there's this sense of in California that everything is so new and that you can reinvent yourself and that the past is gone. And so I'm trying to contrast in that story that her movement from California to the house where she grew up and her discovery that in many ways that past is not gone. And she discovers, you know, things about this great aunt and her experience with the shipwreck and the fact that she was married and had a child again, it's a story that everyone has forgotten or has decided to keep hidden, you know, that reemerges and that she finds particularly has particular resonance for where she is in her own life now, separated from her husband and, you know, trying to take care of two young children on her own as she's also working during a financial crisis in California. And so she's going through her own sort of survival. And she finds particular resonance in the story of her great aunt and that discovery.
That's a moving story.
So again, it's about family and history and discovering connection to it. And, you know, you can discover inspiration as well as dismay.
I like that story a lot. But the title story comes next. We're back to John Jacobs Howland. He's the narrator again, and his sister's about to have a pretend wedding. And that's when their grandfather announces that he's planning to die. What's going on here?
Well, I'm laughing because I had so much fun. I had a lot of fun writing the story. It's, I mean, I'm talking about history and family and dark things, but I really enjoyed bringing humor into these stories. And this story in particular, you know, he arrives and his sister's taken on the island where he grew up. And there's all this anxiety within the family now that the grandfather's so old about what's going to happen to the island house, who's going to inherit it. And, the sister, John's sister, younger John's sister, is the only one with any money in the family. She's gone into business and lives in New York. And so there's a lot of anxiety about her and whether she'll sort of push the others out. And so a lot of this story is about this sort of anxiety about hanging on to the past or pieces of it, you know, things like real estate, you know, or some people fight over, you know, a bureau or a desk, something that physically represents that identity and that past. And it's a little bit making fun of ridiculing in a way, the anxiety of, you know, identifying too much with those items, with those, it's just dirt and it's just, you know, it's just a house and letting go of that. And at the end of the story, you know, he asks his girlfriend who he's come to the island with, you know, what am I going to do? And she says, well, basically, you're just going to be like the rest of us. You're going to get over the fact, you and your family and everyone like that is going to get over the fact that you think you're the center of the universe.
Which, that was a wonderful one. And then there's a couple of more stories, but your final story, a couple more stories going forward until 2013. And then in your final story, you're going back in time to the matriarch when she left. She left Scotland at 1741 and endured unbelievable hardships. And this story is really kind of difficult, very beautifully done, but difficult to read how much she suffered.
Yeah, this is Sarah Campbell's story, and this is based on a real story and that's been sort of documented. I'm supposedly related to her, and she moved to the area of Maine where I grew up in this era in 1741. So a lot of my family in my Maine family are from that sort of Anglo WASP tradition, but quite a few of them are from the Scottish tradition as well. And a lot of Maine was settled by Scots in the 1700s, many of whom were pushed off the land by the English and by after the Battle of Culloden, the new lairds, who they called the sheep lairds. They essentially replaced the Highlanders with sheep. Anyway, the idea is Sarah Campbell is part of that diaspora of Scots to Maine, and they arrived in Maine at an incredibly brutal moment in the early to mid 1700s. It was the Afghanistan of New England. It was a war zone. So I've counted, you know, by looking through historical documents, I think I lost 25 great grandparents to various, you know, combat situations with the in the French and Indian Wars. And she was in that era, and it was a very, very hard time. And she particularly, her particular story is just unbelievable. But it's, you know, supposedly based on a real narrative.
Wow.
And so I kind of recast that narrative a little bit and infused a little bit into it. And, but I have a particular attachment to it because I feel the realness of it. And it doesn't matter whether I'm related to her or not. Her story represents the sort of fortitude of so many people, but so many women, you know, who were on, you know, came, to the frontier at that time. And, of course they came and they were in conflict with the native people of that area who, were completely, almost completely wiped out of Southern Maine and the mid-coast Maine by the end of the 1700s. So that's the sort of story that lingers in the background of all these stories, is a consciousness that her story represents great suffering, but so do the stories of the people who her, you know, group were coming to replace, basically on the land.
So there's no,
anyway,
there's no native population in Maine, or
there are some reservations down east, Passamaquoddy, and then the Mi'kmaq are up northern Maine, going into New Brunswick. But a lot of the conflict in 1700s Maine was in southern and central Maine. That's where a lot of the sort of Anglo settlement creeped up the coast from Massachusetts and created conflict between the native population and the French, who are often, you know, working with the native population to try to push the English and Scottish population out, and Irish too.
Oh, wow. So this is quite...
Anyway, sorry. I don't know if that's...
Quite a powerful story.
I don't know.
Really.
Yeah, and I wanted to end on that and on the previous story, Wintering Over. I have a sense that the main character, John, and his, you know, he's coming from a patriarchy, but in a way he's moving into a more of a matriarchy, if that makes sense. I mean, there's a sense that the stories that he grew up with and the culture and ethos that he grew up with was male dominated and patriarchal, and that women's stories were sort of not included in his mythology. But that I wanted to start shifting that around, as my sense of that has shifted in my own life, and my sense of my family, own family history, has changed over the years as I've come to learn about stories like Sarah Campbell's, and I'm also related to Anne Hutchinson, who is also an incredibly heroic figure of American history.
So, tell us. So we spent a lot of time on this book, but I know you must be working on other things. What's happening next?
Well, speaking of the women of the family, I am co-writing a book with my sister, who spent a lot of time working in the humanitarian aid space, I guess you would call it. She spent a lot of time in Afghanistan and Iraq and Haiti over the last 20 years. And she was involved in working with the Yazidi population of northern Iraq.
Yeah.
And so she was in charge of this woman's campaign, Nadia Murad, who won the Nobel Peace Prize last year. And so my sister and I are co-writing a book on causes, basically humanitarian causes, and that sort of centers around the Yazidi cause, the Yazidi genocide. And so that's been taking up a lot of my time for the last 6 months, but I love short stories, and I can't wait to get back to them.
Okay, because this is a nonfiction project.
This is, yes, very much a nonfiction project, and it's a relief to, in a way, to write about people who have nothing to do with me or my history, or, you know, but to try to do some writing that really feels like it's trying to bring some important issues of international justice, you know, into the public consciousness.
That sounds really interesting. I'll look forward to it. Anyway, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host of New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with Jason Brown, author of A Faithful But Melancholy Account of Several Barbarities Lately Committed, a collection of linked stories. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Book Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle is an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creativity community. As New Book Network listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to www.shuffle.do/NBN/join.